Blog Talk Radio.
Have you heard of passive aerobics? Now you can build muscle, burn fat, and enjoy the benefits of jogging a mile and a half in just 10 minutes. That's right, you can accomplish your fitness goals easier than you've ever dreamed. With the state-of-the-art Vibe Pro and Qi Pro fitness machines that are lightweight and small enough for any home or office, if you sit most of the day and want a great workout, or if you suffer from tight muscles from your exercise program, you will benefit from these body-balancing machines that the Hollywood stars use to feel and look great. For the best you, go to besthealthgallery.com. Best products, prices, and service, that's besthealthgallery.com. Or call 480-888-6548. 480-888-6548. Build muscle, burn fat, and enjoy the benefits of jogging a mile and a half in just 10 minutes. Call 480-888-6548. besthealthgallery.com.
Be a part of the next big technological breakthrough. Hi, I'm William Malik, President and CEO of Aurora Tech, a.k.a. Dr. Houdini on Vortex Network News. Free energy and anti-gravity technology now being developed at Aurora Tech will change the way we live and bring about a golden age for all mankind. Our motto, simply the most advanced technology on planet Earth. To get involved with great opportunities at Aurora Tech, please check out our website, auroratech.us. That's auroratech.us. auroratech.us. And call 480-474-4388. 480-474-4388. Simply the most advanced technology on planet Earth. auroratech.us.
Latest in conspiracies, cover-ups, suppressed technology, UFOs, and extraterrestrial contact. Vortex Network News with your hosts, Aurora Light and Dr. Houdini.
Live from Scottsdale, Arizona, you're listening to Vortex Network News, and I am your host this evening, Dr. Houdini. Well, folks, Aurora Light's taking a night off. So I will be your exclusive host for the evening here. So I just want to mention to you all that, yes, it's been another busy week here at Aurora Tech. We've been working very hard getting ready for a conference that's coming up here end of July. And I'm working towards actually showing over unity free energy technology. And, of course, that's going to be the subject of my lecture at this conference, which is going to be the physics of free energy over unity transformers. That's going to be my first lecture, which is going to be given at the Extraordinary Technology Conference, and that's going to be Thursday afternoon at 2:30 p.m. My second lecture is going to be with the other group, the Coffee Group, Conference on Future Energy. That is Tom Vallone's group. And that is a co-conference with the Extraordinary Technology Conference here in Albuquerque. And as co-conference, I will be giving a lecture on developing practical warp drive technology. So what is all this technology based on? Well, it's been research I've been doing for a number of years here, since the late 1990s. Back in 97, I went to a lecture, and the presenter was, of course, the researcher, energy researcher by the name of Tom Bearden. Tom Bearden. And he's a heavyweight in the field of exotic energy technologies. And I thought I was quite privileged to go and listen to his lecture on free energy and anti-gravity And I was just simply blown away by it. And of course, Tom written a number of, and you can go and check those papers out. They are on my website. It's my research website by the name of intellect.com, and that's spelled intalek.com. You can check out that website. I have a very large library that I've collected over many years of these exotic technologies going back many, many decades, actually. There's been a lot of researchers in this field over the decades here. And I assembled a library of information. And I'm always collecting more and more information here as time goes by. I collected a very interesting paper by a researcher by the name of, William Hooper. His last name is Hooper. And what's interesting about his paper, which I believe he wrote back in 1974, is that his research dealt with with electric and magnetic fields, and that the effect of fields produced by electrons, for example, these fields are relativistic effects. So, in other words, they involve Einstein's theory of special relativity, which mainly deals with a mass in motion, that as this mass moves faster and faster, the field energy produced by the fundamental particles increases. And it increases to the point where as you approach the speed of light, the field energy becomes infinite. And so that is the major limitation why spaceships, for example, travel faster than the speed of light. If you look at just ordinary rocketry, it would take you, 20 years just to get to the nearest star system, which is Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri, that star system, which I believe is 4.3 light years away, would take you using rocket technology, 20 years just to get to. And I'll tell you right, that's optimistic, all right? That's thinking very optimistically. Because what speed are you moving at? You know, half the speed of light? You know, something on that order. So you're talking about a massive, massive, massive rocket-type system just to get you to the nearest star. And so from the perspective of exotic technologies, there's other ways of doing this. And we all saw it in we saw this in science fiction. For example, Star Trek. Star Trek is an excellent example of exotic technology, whereby warping space would create a propulsion type effect. Although they're not too clear about that in the Star Trek series. Another researcher by the name of Mike Will Okubre proposed a warp drive engine design back in the mid-1990s. And he published those papers. They were accepted by his peers. And NASA kind of seized on it. But the thing is that it's only a theoretical model. So in other words, they don't really have a means of actually implementing a warp drive engine. Now, what does he do? Well, you can look up the Okubre warp drive. Just on the internet here, just look up Okubre warp drive. And you'll see all kinds of information on the internet here just pop up in front of you. And the long and short of it is that what the Okubre warp drive is it's a warpage of space where you curve, you have a negative space-time curvature in front of your craft. And behind your craft, you have a positive space-time curvature. Okay? And this deals mainly with the compression and rarefaction of space that occurs. And what El-Khoubary discovered, okay, with this theoretical model, is that it creates a means of propulsion. It would be considered a reactionless space drive, is another way of looking at this, an inertialess means of propelling yourself through space. And what his warp drive does is it creates a fall forward scenario just by warping negatively, a negative space-time curvature in front of your craft, positive space-time curvature behind your craft, and you create this fall forward scenario that moves you through space. And of course, between these curvatures, you have a flat space-time that's isolated from the space-time outside of your space-time curvatures. Okay, so so the craft would essentially experience no inertial effects because you're not coupled. Okay, the space-time between your curvatures are not coupled to space-time outside of those curvatures. Okay, you're isolated. You created an isolated bubble. Okay, between these curvatures. So there's no inertial effects. So you can go as fast as you want, and you would not feel the inertia, okay, of acceleration at all. You would not feel any acceleration effects at all. And the other thing that El-Khoubary discovered is that with his design, you can go many, many times the speed of light, which I thought was rather interesting. So the question here, do we actually have a model for Star Trek? So that's something to think about. And, of course, that's going to be the subject of my discussion here at the Coffee Conference, end of July. And what I'm going to be talking about is an actual implementation of a warp drive engine. Now, all this is based on the Dirac C of negative energy, which, of course, Paul Dirac published back in the late 1920s. About 1928 is when he published his Dirac equation. And the result of his equation shows that E equals plus or minus mc squared. And of course, you heard of E equals mc squared, right? Everyone has heard of something like that, which just simply equates energy with mass, okay, times the speed of light squared. So you can say in, for example, a particle of mass that has mass, the amount of energy that is bound, okay, in that mass. And so that's what E equals mc squared is all about. And so what Dirac discovered was something very interesting here, and that is E equals plus or minus mc squared. And so what we have here, the solution to this Dirac equation, plus or minus mc squared, is that mass can either be positive or you can have a negative mass, which results in the energy being positive or negative energy. Now, the physicists back then did not want to deal with this negative energy component, so they found a mathematical trick to eliminate it, which was later proven to be an incorrect solution. And so now we're back to dealing with the full Dirac solution here of E equals plus or minus mc squared. But you see, it hasn't quite migrated from something that is incorrect to something that's corrected in today's textbooks, because obviously they do not teach the negative energy solution of the Dirac equation. It's just not taught today. So we're left with technologies that only implement positive energy all the way down to 0 point, but not beyond. And so simply by putting the negative energy solution back into the Dirac equation, all of a sudden we find out that we can do all these exotic technologies. We can do anti-gravity, we can do warp drive, and also these free energy over unity type energy technologies. And so that's pretty much going to be the subject of what I'll be talking about in these lectures here. And of course, the fellow that brought all this to light was a researcher by the name of Don Hodson, who published an incredible paper, which you'll find on my roartech.us website. You find a Hodson, Don Hodson wrote a fantastic article describing the Dirac sea of negative energy and essentially the correct interpretation, how you would interpret Dirac's equation and the kind of solutions that would come out of that. And so by really digging into it, and I've been digging into it now for a couple of years here, primarily focused on Don Hodson's paper, The Dirac Sea of Negative Energy, bringing it to life, so to speak, putting it into picture form so that it's easily understood. And the main focus here is that Don Hodson, what he talks about, is what Lorentz was working on back in the early 1900s. Of course, he didn't live long enough, okay, to see the Dirac equation, because if he did, all the pieces of the puzzle would have come together. And what that means is that Don Hodson, putting all the pieces together here, talks about an ether. And you recall that a conspiracy was launched here to eliminate the ether, that the ether does not exist. And later, of course, Einstein comes along and says, no, there really is an ether. But in a way, we don't know what's in ether. Well, what's interesting about that is, of course, with what Don Hodson's talking about here, is that we do know what's in the ether here, or what makes up the ether. And it is the Lorentz electromagnetic ether, which, of course, consists of electron-positron pairs. But the problem is that, you know, over the decades, the language that was created and then attached to quantum mechanics, for example, here, in the quantum world, was based on an etherless design, so to speak, that there is no ether. We only have these macro particles, you know, like quarks and gluons and electrons and positrons, you know, all these fundamental particles, and that's everything we know. That's it. And they call that the standard model in physics. And so what we have here is the vacuum of space that's completely empty, and we have the standard model of physics, which only includes you know, all these little fundamental particles, and that's it. That describes everything there is. Well, what's interesting about Hodson's work and the Dirac Sea of Negative Energy here is that the standard model is not the correct model. It's inherently flawed. And so over the decades here, you know, experiments after experiments have been popping up, and these physicists have been publishing their results. And this whole notion that that there is no ether, all of a sudden there is an ether, and it's composed of these electron-positron pairs. And so that that directly flies in the face of the establishment and what they established back in the 1920s. Really, all this occurred in the 1930s is when they established the rules regarding the quantum world. And this is how we're going to work with it. And so they added these words called annihilation and creation. Annihilation events and creation events. And how that, you know, creates particles. These particles have a certain amount of energy when they're created. And when they annihilate, they produce these high energy photons. And when they vanish from sight, they're gone. And that's proving to be incorrect, not a correct model at all. And so the Dirac-C of negative energy is, in a way, kind of gaining some momentum here. And, of course, the brilliant work that Don Hodgson has done, you know, publishing his work on the Dirac-C of negative energy, really puts a spotlight on a lot of this new research. And it's given me a basis, a very sound basis, to explain free energy and over-unity technology. And really, to develop this technology, you have to have this fundamental framework that's in place. Because otherwise, you're not going to know what to look for. Okay, because the Dirac-C of negative energy makes predictions, and you can test these predictions, okay? It creates an incredible model for predicting these effects, especially in free energy and over-unity transformers, developing practical warp drive technology, and of course, that's what I'll be getting into here with my lectures that are coming up end of July. So I'll be getting into the nitty-gritty with that. Okay, so I think right now we're going to take a short break. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Vortex Network News, and I am your host, Dr. Houdini. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Vortex Network News, and I'm your host this evening, Dr. Houdini. All right, well, the first half hour of the show, we're getting into some of the physics, talking quite a bit about Hodson's work here, and the Dirac-C of negative energy. And of course, you can read about that. His paper is on my website, and it was published in Infinite Energy magazine back in 2002. And so the website to look that up, just go to aurortech.us, aurortech.us. Look under the science section and just scroll down, and you'll see Hodson's paper on the Dirac-C of negative energy. Okay, now, what are we talking about here with the Lorentz electromagnetic ether? Now, based on Hodson's work, what the ether is, it consists of electron-positron pairs. And according to Hodson, they have a condition of a boson spin zero macroparticle, which means that they can take on angular momentum, and that angular momentum can be delivered, for example, from an electron. An electron can dump its angular momentum. And what these pairs do is that they form these chains in the vacuum by acquiring that angular momentum. And that angular momentum turns out to be a photon. So a photon is, according to Hodson and the Dirac-C of negative energy and the Lorentz electromagnetic ether, is not a particle. It's not really a wave either. It's not a wave or a particle. It's angular momentum that gets dumped on this chain that's formed of these electron-positron pairs. And what that does is polarize the ether. So in other words, they form these long flux chains. In other words, they come back, you know, for example, in a magnetic field, the chains come back and they must connect to a positron, for example, and that completes the circuit that is in space. And it turns out, when I did the calculations, and of course this is going to be part of my lecture, the field energy of the electron turns out to be the mass of the electron, which I thought was rather interesting. So in other words, these particles really aren't particles at all. They're just an empty vortex. That's all that an electron is, an empty vortex, where the charge is on the outside or the shell of this vortex. And there's nothing there on the inside of this vortex. It's just an empty shell or an empty vortex. There's no electric field, no magnetic field, no mass inside these fundamental particles. All the mass is on the outside of the electron, and it shows up as the field energy or angular momentum of the electron, and it's capable of dumping that angular momentum to form these long chains in the ether that we call fields. And it can be electric or magnetic fields or a combination of both. And so what we have are photons, which really are neither a particle or wave. They're just angular momentum that gets dumped along this chain. And you can read all about that in the Hodson papers here. And that's going to be what I'm going to be talking about here in terms of the Lorentz electromagnetic ether, which should be a very interesting report here. So it applies to both free energy transformers and warp drive engines. So I thought I'd read the abstract of developing practical warp drive engine technology. I'll just give you a little intro of what my lecture is going to be about here. So the abstract reads as follows. Vacuum polarization of the Lorentz electromagnetic ether is a critical concept towards understanding how to design and develop practical warp drive engines. The ether is understood to be made of polarizable boson spin zero, one-dimensional strings, or electron-positron pairs, known as EPOS, E-P-O-S. Now, that's language that you'll find in Don Hodgson's Dear Axis of Negative Energy. So these electron pairs, electron-positron pairs, fill the entire vacuum of space. And where do they exist? Well, they exist at zero point and is known as the perturbations or the quantum flux. Okay, so I go on to say here that the warpage or bending due to vacuum polarization, because what we're doing, we're polarizing these electron-positron pairs. In other words, we change their nature. Okay, from boson spin zero, just random particle fluctuations, and we give them order. Okay, we have them form these lines of flux where they acquire angular momentum from an electron, for example. So the warpage or bending due to vacuum polarization, because that's what we're doing here, we're polarizing the electron-positron pairs, causes the EPOS, the electron-positron pairs, to become boson spin 1 pairs with angular momentum. So in other words, they acquire angular momentum from an electron. And so they become a boson spin 1 macroparticle. Now this can be accomplished using either electric or magnetic forces, or a combination of both forces. An example of electron or of electric vacuum polarization is the Byfield-Brown effect. And that, of course, was developed back in the 1920s, Byfield-Brown experiment. You can look this up on the internet. Back in the 1920s. And an example of magnetic vacuum polarization is, of course, the German Nazi Bell device, which was developed 10 years later, back in the 1930s and late 30s. Simply by engineering the vacuum using these forces causes compression, producing a negative space-time curvature, and rarefaction, producing a positive space-time curvature, which in turn creates what is known as the Alcubierre warp field signature, which was first published back in 1994. So this is an essential idea towards understanding faster than light interstellar space travel. So what we're doing here is polarizing the vacuum. And it's generally referred to as asymmetric vacuum polarization. Asymmetric vacuum polarization. So what we're doing here to create this fall forward scenario, okay, outlined by Alcubierre and his Alcubierre warp drive, is that you create a negative space-time curvature in front of your craft, positive space-time curvature behind your craft, to create this fall forward scenario. Okay, it's inertialess, there's no inertia, propulsion methodology. And so how we actually implement this idea, okay, is that if we use the magnetic approach, is that we vacuum polarize in front of your craft, causing a compression of the ether. So in other words, we compress the ether in front of the craft, and that can be done magnetically. A magnet, for example, does this compression. Now, the rarefaction component of this, the positive space-time curvature, we cause that by creating an opposing magnetic field scenario, okay, anti-gravity. This opposition actually rarefacts the space behind the craft. So that's where we get the positive space-time curvature from, by using a rarefaction method or opposing magnetic fields. Those are fields in opposition to one another. Now, the electric method was already developed by the Byfield-Brown effect, where they use an electric, very high voltage. And so what they do, for example, the lifters, Tim Ventura and his lifter concept. Well, the mainstream has mainly written that off, okay, as just an ionization effect. But I say no, it's not ionization that's occurring here. What we're doing is that we're creating this fall forward scenario using the electric force, where it's concentrated above the craft with a wire. You have a wire, and then below the wire is foil. So we concentrate the ether using the electric force by the wire, and then we spread the ether out, rarefact the ether with the foil. So in other words, the lines of flux in this case, the electric lines of flux, are spread out over a wide surface area. So we're creating this fall forward scenario where we concentrate the ether at the top of this lifter, is what they called Tim Ventura's lifter, for example. By the wire, you concentrate the ether by the wire, and then you rarefact the ether with the foil and distribute it over a surface. That is your asymmetric vacuum polarization effect right there. And so that pretty much describes the Byfield-Brown effect. And both methods are, I would consider, warp drive technology. Now, how do we get this craft moving quickly? Well, the other technique that you have to apply to this, and there's always multiple effects going on here. It's not just, you cannot isolate just one effect and call it what it is. There's always these multiple effects going on. And part of my work is identifying these different effects that are occurring to create this the scenario of anti-gravity and warp drive technology. And of course, these multiple effects is, number one, you have to modify the mass of your craft. And the other thing you have to do is to apply a vacuum polarization effect to get your propulsion. It's a combination of mass modification and propulsion that moves you at very high speeds very quickly. And so this is why, with the Byfield-Brown effect, you can only use lightweight materials, okay, to see the effect. For example, Tim Ventura's lifter technology, he used balsa wood sticks and aluminum foil and a copper wire. And so he set these up in his apparatus to see the Byfield-Brown effect at work. And of course, the Byfield-Brown experiment used, I believe, was aluminum, very thin aluminum sheets. And the electrification of those sheets would cause this effect to manifest. And so you can only use lightweight materials to see the effect. So then how do we build, for example, a massive spacecraft, like something that you see in Star Trek, something that weighs, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of tons, and yet move that beyond the speed of light very quickly. Well, how do you do that? Well, you have to employ a mass modification technique to make that happen. And so I'm going to touch on that in my lecture, is of course mass modification. Now, have I actually done the experiments with this? Well, absolutely yes. And that is, of course, the Boyd-Bushman experiment illustrates this concept of mass modification. And also another effect that's there, and that's the modification of the gravitational constant. So in other words, gravity is not a constant. You can engineer it. Okay, the strength of gravity comes out, of course, with the Newton's equation for gravity, where the force equals big G times your two masses divided by the distance between those two masses. It's the inverse square law. So it's the distance between the two masses squared. And so what you have is a force between these two masses that's an attractive force. And so it turns out that we're not only modifying the mass of our system, because that's what occurs with the Biefeld-Brown effect. You're modifying the mass of your system, but you're also changing the space around that craft. And the space that you're changing interacts with this, with big G, the gravitational constant, because big G is the strength of gravity. And that's actually engineerable. You could actually engineer that. And so what we see here are two effects. We see a mass modification effect and a modification of the space around that craft, which affects big G. Okay, so, yes, I will be talking about this at the coffee conference, getting into those details. Now, as I alluded here, you know, I did the experiments, the experiment with here. I successfully replicated the Boyd-Bushman experiment, and you can see that under the science section, where I did this drop test of magnets. And, of course, the magnets can be in the attractive configuration, or the magnets can be in this opposing configuration. And both methods actually modify the space, how gravity interacts with that magnet around the magnet, which means that the big G is engineerable, okay, around these magnetic fields. And so what Boyd-Bushman discovered and described in a video, which I look at as a huge breakthrough, okay, because it's an experiment that you, the listener, can replicate if you wanted to do so. All you need to do is to find a bridge, either a bridge or a building tall enough where you can actually see the effect occur. Now, of course, I videotaped it. The effect that I observed, the building was only 30 feet off the ground, and you couldn't really see it, you know, as I replicated his experiment, but you can see it on video, and the effect shows up on video, and that video is available on our website. You can check it out yourself and see how magnets influence the gravitational constant, and also there is a mass modification going on. So in order to bend space requires a mass, right? You have to have a mass to bend space around that mass. I mean, that's classically known. That's what they teach for gravity, is that in order to bend space requires the presence of a mass. And of course, with the magnet enhances that effect. because of the vacuum polarization effect around that magnet, you're concentrating the electromagnetic ether around that magnet. So there's more of a mass effect, okay, that's being emitted. You know, the mass of the electron is on the outside of the electron and is radiated as its field energy of that electron. That's the mass of your electron, is the field energy that's emitted. And so that's what gets passed along in the flux lines, okay, the Lorentz electromagnetic ether, these electron-positron pairs. So I'm going to show how the vacuum, okay, the electromagnetic ether, is polarized to produce this effect. And, of course, asymmetric vacuum polarization is, of course, your means of propulsion. And added with that is your mass modification component. You have to have mass modification. You have to remove the mass component. Okay, and I'll talk about how to do that in the lecture, such that the effect greatly enhances. Okay, once you reduce the mass of your ship, all right, then the effect, the Biefeld-Braun effect, becomes dominant, you see. It's not dominant if you have a megaton craft you're trying to move, right? And you apply the Biefeld-Braun effect, it's not going to go anywhere. But if you take that megaton craft and eliminate the mass of that craft, and there's techniques for that, then, of course, the Biefeld-Braun effect becomes dominant. You know, the Nazi Bell effect, okay, of magnetic vacuum polarization becomes a dominating effect once you reduce that mass component. So I'll get into some of that detail in this lecture. Okay, so that pretty much covers developing practical warp drive engine technology. And of course, with the lecture, you know, it's going to be a slideshow, actually a PowerPoint. I'll have a PowerPoint presentation, so you'll get a good visual idea of where we're going with all this. Now, it's interesting to note here, and I just saw that. Okay, if you go to the coffee, if you go to the list of speakers at the coffee conference, it's interesting to note because Tom Vallone, you can click on a link. If you go and see the okay, the description of the coffee conference, you click on the schedule and this PDF comes up showing the schedule of speakers. I'm, of course, speaking Saturday afternoon at 1 p.m. on July 29th is when I'll be talking about developing practical warp drive engine technology. It's interesting to note that Tom presented some emails that he received. One, of course, was from Dr. Hal Puthoff. He was pretty much into the research of anti-gravity, this warp drive technology, back in the late 1990s. And this is when NASA was putting on conferences. And I did attend one of those NASA conferences back in the I believe it was the late 90s. And there were some speakers there. Hal Puthoff wasn't there. But I know Hal has been a researcher in this field for quite some time. Now, he wrote an interesting little side note that I'll talk about here. Because they're talking about some of the researchers here, and I know some of them did present at the NASA Breakthrough Propulsion Group back in the late 1990s, and that of course was sponsored by NASA. And the fellow by the name of Glenn Robertson, James Purvis, Russ Anderson and myself will present their propellantless space drive theories, along with Don Reed's scalar electrodynamics. Bob DeBoss and Mike Gamble return with Dr. Ludwig to update us on their propulsion inventions, which are coming along with some financial assistance from ERIE. Not surprisingly, Dr. Hal Puthoff and other physicists have emailed Tom Vallone in the past year explaining how the conservation of momentum tied to the homogeneity of space cannot be modified to account for experimentally discovered conversion of angular momentum to linear force. Now here, angular momentum to linear force, he's talking about these systems that rotate to create linear motion. And it's interesting to note that Mike Gamble talked about that last year. I believe it was last year, talking about Boeing's work. And most of the satellites up there implement a special configuration of gyroscopes that give you linear force. So it kind of calls into question here about what Hal Puthoff is talking about and other physicists that have emailed Tom Vallone, that you cannot, the conservation of momentum cannot be modified to account for experimentally discovered conversion of angular momentum to linear force. So that's where you use these rotating systems to convert their motion to linear motion. But I know Mike gave a fantastic discussion last year about this, about how gyroscopes can be used to create linear motion with. And he was saying a number of satellites use this in orbit. So they don't all use a propellant to reorient satellites, that you can use this means of gyroscopic motion that will convert to a linear force. So that is very interesting here. So, okay. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about this. My discussion, of course, will be Saturday. Well, okay, we're at the top of the hour here. Let's take a break. You're listening to Vortex Network News. I'm your host this evening, Dr. Houdini, and we'll be right back. Thank you.
What is it about robots that makes them so robotic? At Wayland Industries, it has long been our goal to create artificial intelligence almost indistinguishable from mankind itself. Hello, I'm David.
What can you do, David?
I can do almost anything that could possibly be asked of me. I can assist your employees. I can make your organization more efficient. I can carry out directives that my human counterparts might find distressing or unethical. I can blend in with your workforce effortlessly.
David, what do you think about?
I think about anything. Children play. Angel. The universe. Robot.
David, what makes you sad?
War, poverty, cruelty, unnecessary violence. I understand human emotions, although I do not feel them myself. This allows me to be more efficient and capable, and makes it easier for my human counterparts to interact with me.
Is there anything you would like to say, David?
I would like to express gratitude to those who created me. Happy birthday, David. From Wayland Industries. Eighth generation Wayland type. Technological, intellectual, physical, emotional.
You're up to see the wizard, the wonderful wizard of Oz.
And we're back. You're listening to Vortex Network News. I'm your host this evening, Dr. Houdini. We are broadcasting live here from Scottsdale, Arizona. All right. Well, Aurora Light's taking the night off tonight. She'll probably be back next week. All right. I want to touch on this story here. And, of course, the competitor to Uber is Lyft, L-Y-F-T, Lyft Corporation. And they have, I noticed this very interesting article. And the title of this article is that Lyft targets 1 billion electric self-driving rides per year by 2025. What do you think about that, folks? 1 billion electric self-driving rides per year by 2025. Boy, that's a rather aggressive goal, wouldn't you say? Now, this article here was published at nextbigfuture.com, and it says here that Lyft announced new climate goals for Lyft platform. As we do our part to ensure the United States remains on track to meet the goals of the Paris Accord, which, of course, Trump nixed. So much for climate change, right? But you see, there's kind of a bait and switch with this article, and I'll get to it here. To guide them in these efforts, we are proud to welcome pioneering environmentalist and author Paul Harkin, executive director of Project Drawdown, as an advisor to Lyft. Paul will inform our climate action strategy, and help us maximize the environmental benefits of our platform as we take this important step to sustainability. Lift climate impact goals. And they have these bullet points here. First bullet point, all electric autonomous vehicles operating on the Lyft platform will be powered by 100% renewable energy. This will be true from day one, starting with the Newtonomy autonomous vehicles in Boston later this year. Second bullet point, by 2025, Lyft's shared platform will provide at least 1 billion rides per year using electric autonomous vehicles. Third bullet point, Lyft's efforts will reduce CO2 emissions for the U.S. transportation sector as a whole by at least 5 million tons per year by 2025. An aggressive goal, wouldn't you say? So they believe that ride sharing combined with autonomous vehicles will be the driving force that brings electric vehicles from a tiny portion, about 0.1% of all cars on the road today, to a significant majority within 20 years. This belief is supported by a leading think tank and research laboratories. The average car is used only 4% of the time, and for electric vehicles, it takes 10 years or more to recover the cost premium through fuel savings. 10 years, huh? In comparison, Lyft vehicles can be used much more efficiently. An electric autonomous Lyft vehicle will be utilized over 50% of the time and pay back its cost in just a few years through operational savings. These savings will dramatically accelerate the rollout of electric vehicles, displacing millions of gasoline-powered vehicles and helping the U.S. and the world reach their climate goals. And as I said previously, Trump nixed the Paris Accord. All right, so what is the problem with this article? Well, I'll tell you right now, there are plenty of problems with this. And of course, they don't look at those issues at all, folks. And the issue here is of course, what is the weak point in an electric car? Of course, it's the power source, right? It's the batteries. The batteries are very, very unreliable. Case in point, we drive a Camry hybrid that, of course, has two batteries in it. One, of course, is the electric battery that powers the electric motor. And the other battery just powers the 12-volt electronics, you know, in the car, you know, like headlights and things of that nature. So it does require an alternator, which runs, well, there is a gasoline engine in our hybrid. And of course, that is used to charge the electric battery for the electric drive. Of course, there's an alternator in there that powers the 12-volt electric battery. Now, the problem with the hybrid is of course, the battery failure. And you can only get about 3.5 to 4 year life out of those batteries if you drive it normally. And to us, normally is is something like 100,000 miles a year, something like that. You know, we do use our cars. Okay, so the weak point is the battery, And you can only get about maybe 3.5 to 4 year life out of those big batteries. And they cost about $4,000 to replace. And I guarantee you that battery will fail. That is a guarantee. And of course, it is covered by the warranty. You know, the first battery, if it fails, I believe it, if it failed right around 100,000 miles, could be wrong about that, they will replace that battery for free. If you exceed the warranty, of course, you got to belly up to the bar with that price tag of $4,000. Now, and incidentally, we are on our third battery. Okay, so, and we bought that car back in 2008. Yeah, we bought that car back in 2008, and we're on our third battery. So I guarantee you, those the battery technology will eventually fail in every one of those electric cars, guaranteed. Now, the battery pack for a Tesla, for example, now the Model S, I believe it's the Model S that's very popular. They're very popular here in Scottsdale. People love their Tesla Model S car. You see them all over the place. That battery to replace, if I'm not kidding, I believe is $20,000. I kid you not. The battery pack, it's under the car frame. It the whole base between the tires, between the front and the back tires, is a massive battery pack. And I'm not sure on the life of that battery pack, but it cost $20,000 to replace. And the thing about the Model S is that you can only get about maybe a maximum range of somewhere around 200 to 230 miles on a charge. Now, the problem with... That was Aurora. The issue with these battery packs. All right. The issue with the battery packs is that, yes, they have to be replaced. And number two, the Model S is about $20,000. And you only have a range about 200, 230 miles per charge. And that derates over time. But the thing is that when you pull into your garage, you then hook up a charger to it. And the idea, well, they like to publicize that zero emissions, right? I mean, you're not burning any gasoline, so that means zero emissions. But that isn't exactly true, because when you plug into your house power system, you are contributing to the climate. Okay. So, you know, the thing is that the power company is still supplying power to your car. And here we have nuclear power, the Verde nuclear power plant. So you're using nuclear fission, okay, to power your car. And of course, there's no emissions there, right? But you are producing radioactivity, waste product. So it's not a true clean approach here. Okay, when they say 100% renewable energy, what are they using here? Wind power, solar power. And there was an interesting report that I ran across here that it takes more energy to make a solar cell than it is than the energy you get out of it when you apply it in an application. Is that true? That is a very good question. If you put more energy into making the solar cell, then all the energy you get out of that solar cell in an application. That's a very interesting argument. So it's kind of questionable regarding the overall efficiency of these renewable energy systems that are out there. So the article is kind of questionable here in terms of these autonomous vehicles, because the weak point in every battery-operated system is, of course, the battery. And if you can eliminate the battery, then you can eliminate the huge problem with all these electric appliances, right? And that's what we're looking at with our technology, is eliminating the battery. Okay. Well, I'm getting a notification here from Aurora that she wants me to get off the air right now. She's hungry. The woman is hungry. So I have to close out the show. So I want to thank you all for joining me this week on Vortex Network News. And where is my closeout music here? Where did it go? Oh, here we go. So join me next week on Vortex Network News. Have a great week, everyone. We'll be back.
Vehicle?
Given your background, I would have thought you'd seen one.
No, never, not like that.
Tad O'Malley takes Mulder to see an ARV, an alien replica vehicle.
But we're showing you we do at great risk. Colleagues have had labs burned to the ground and work destroyed by our own government.
This vehicle is said to be running on free energy.
Simply the energy of the universe. No fuel, no flame, no combustion. Simple electromagnetic field.
There's a tremendous attention to detail on the show, and there always has been.
What I'm going to show you next is the most unbelievable part.
When I saw that first ARV, I was blown away by the texture of it, the scale of it.
You're off to see the wizard, the wonderful wizard of Oz. You'll find he is the wizard of wiz, if ever a wizard was. If ever, ever a wizard was, the wizard of Oz is one because of the wonderful things he does. You're off to see the wizard, the wonderful wizard of Oz.